we will, as the parties reset, I'll have the marshal call our second case, please.
Case number A24-1536, Progressive Preferred Insurance Company versus Adventure Manufacturing Incorporated.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
As you settle in, just a couple of housekeeping matters. For the first, I want just for the audio record to let everyone know that I'm Judge Bentley presiding today. I'm joined here by Judge Ead and Judge Harris. And by the time, once you're each settled, you'll each have 15 minutes for oral argument this morning. Appellant will then have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And please feel free to adjust the height of the podium if you so choose. There are some buttons in the front that should make that pretty easy. And before beginning your argument, I ask that you each please identify yourselves and your party for the, or excuse me, the party that you represent for the record. So with that, appellant, are you ready?
I am.
Great. Take your time.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Alyssa Johnson, and I have the privilege of representing the appellant, Progressive Preferred Insurance Company. We respectfully ask the court to reverse the district court's summary judgment ruling and remand this matter for trial, as it involves critical factual issues that must be resolved by a jury. The district court erred in two critical ways. First, it improperly weighed competing expert testimony rather than viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to Progressive, the non-moving party. And second, it imposed an incorrect legal standard by requiring direct evidence of a defect, despite Minnesota precedent allowing circumstantial evidence to prove its case. This matter is a straightforward case of a factual dispute with two sets of qualified experts who reached opposite conclusions about a fire's cause, which creates a genuine issue of material fact that should be resolved by a jury, not for a judge to resolve at the summary judgment stage. By way of brief background, this case arises from an RV purchased by Progressive's insured Matthew Peterson on September 25th, 2020. On November 11th, 2020, just 6 weeks after the RV was destroyed by a fire, resulting in a total loss of the vehicle and additional property damage. To investigate, Progressive retained the services of cause and origin investigator David Holman and electrical engineer Matthew Dubbin. From Holman and Dubbin's review of this evidence, it was concluded that the only plausible cause of this fire was a battery failure. While Dubbin was unable to determine the exact cause of the battery failure or defect, he was able to rule out any negligence or wrongdoing by Progressive's insured. Established case law does not require Progressive's expert to identify the exact cause of the defect on a warranty case such as this. In fact, both parties and the district court seem to agree, citing Nelson in the Chatfield cases. However, where the parties seem to differ and where the appellant alleges that the district court went astray is in regard to the Schaefer case, which provides an exception to the use of circumstantial evidence requiring the examination of reasonable alternatives. The plaintiff in Schaefer relied on circumstantial evidence, which is allowed in Nelson and Chatfield. However, the court in Schaefer acknowledged that while circumstantial evidence is allowed, it's not without its limitations. The court decided in Schaefer that circumstantial evidence is only appropriate to infer a defect if it is probable that the product was defective and that there is no evidence of misuse of the product. Dubbin satisfies the Schaefer standard in his report with the following findings. Number one, the fire's origin was determined to be inside the RV's battery compartment based on Dave Holman's findings, surveillance footage of the incident, and analysis of the electrical system. Two, Dubbin concluded the batteries were the only ignition source within that compartment. And number three, Mr. Peterson's actions did not contribute to the fire as he made no modifications or repairs to the RV. For a jury to engage in speculation under circumstances like these, Progressive's expert would need to have acknowledged that a potential cause of the fire was left unconsidered and could not be ruled out. However, that's not the case here. This analysis might reach a different conclusion if Progressive's expert had identified alternative possible causes of the fire that were unrelated to Adventurer's liability, yet Holman and Dubin make no such admissions. The only alternative causes have been suggested solely by Adventurer's experts, and while it's natural for experts in a case to arrive at different conclusions, the court, under a summary judgment standard, must exclusively consider the conclusions or the interpretations of Progressive's expert as the non-moving party. This standard obligates the court to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Progressive, assessing whether its experts considered or ruled out alternative causes that might undermine their own conclusions. In doing so, it does not permit the court to weigh Progressive's expert opinions against Adventurer's to determine which theory is more plausible. The court's duty is to decide.
Can you walk us through just the kind of summary judgment, the burden shifting process in summary judgment here, where they set forth experts that, with the purpose of showing that there was no material dispute of fact, and then what Progressive's burden at that point was, I guess trying to understand when we view the light in the in most favorable to the non-moving party, what do we do with their expert testimony at that point? Can you just kind of walk through because I wonder if
that's
helps
a great,
explain a little bit about what the district court was thinking.
That's a great question, and my answer is a bit long, but the theme of it is that all roads lead back to the summary judgment standard. The judge is not the trier of fact, the jury is. And here, the district court's job was to make sure that Progressive's experts have enough evidence to avoid speculation by a jury as to the cause of the fire. And when you look at where the district court went wrong, it was simply overlooking the summary judgment standard while getting lost in the jury speculation analysis. Going so far as analyzing both Adventurer and Progressive's expert goes beyond the analysis of speculation here, and it requires the court to weigh the evidence, which is inappropriate on a motion for summary judgment. This case, the judge should view all the evidence in this case, but in the light most favorable to Progressive as a non-moving party. And so doing so requires the judge to review the evidence as Progressive expert viewed the evidence in light most favorable to Progressive and to see if Progressive's experts' conclusions require speculation.
So by the time we get to Progressive's experts, does the district court in effect not consider the expert testimony that Adventurer puts forth?
I would say that is correct. In my experience, it is something that doesn't happen very often for a district court to even consider the defendant's expert at the summary judgment stage.
Unless it's consistent with the non-movement's experts, right? I mean,
exactly, exactly. And so here, really, what the judge did was, we believe that they got so caught up in the speculation that they considered all of the alternative theories. And considering all of the alternative theories is a question for a jury. Now, the court's job here was to look at Progressive's expert opinion. Were there any holes in it? Did Progressive's expert leave any causes of the fire open? And I think in this case, an example of a speculation by a jury would be that the fire originated in the RV's battery compartment. The batteries were one of the two ignition sources in the battery compartment, neither of which could be ruled out. And three, Peterson made no modifications or repairs that could have caused the fire. So there, and in contrast, we have the middle saying it could be two things out of the battery compartment, neither of which could be ruled out. That is not the case here. So if I had put forth this in front of the summary judgment in front of the judge, I would agree that this should be thrown out because Progressive theory in itself requires jury speculation. Well, was it one or was it two? But here, we don't have that. And going back to the Schaefer case, the plaintiff experienced a sharp pain immediately after swallowing their first bite of a muffin. The harm-causing object, it was never found. It was never identified. However, immediately after the event, a doctor found a cut on the plaintiff's throat. There was no allegation that the plaintiff had any throat-related ailments before the incident. So here, yes, the plaintiff did rely on circumstantial evidence to prove its case. However, where it differs, and that the court acknowledged the Nelson and the chat field allowed circumstantial evidence, that it's not without its limitations. And it put forth a three-part test for the jury to avoid speculation. And so the first part of that test, was the injury-causing event the kind that will ordinarily occur as a result of the condition? Was the plaintiff responsible for the condition that is the cause of the injury? And number three, was the injury-causing event caused by anything other than a food product defect existing at the time of sale? So comparing that to Mr. Dubbin's report, you have number one, the area of origin as defined by the origin and cause investigator Dave Holman, the surveillance video of the early stages of the fire, and his analysis of the electrical system puts the origin of the fire inside the RV compartment. And in this conclusion, he's excluded a failure or malfunction of the inverter, the charger, the wiring of the batteries, and he's considering the lack of arcing residue on the artifacts supporting a fire originating in the battery compartment.
So that's to exclude, because it was undisputed that the Petersons had used an extension cord, so it excludes the expert opinion. If taken as true at the summary judgment stage, would exclude the extension cord.
Exactly. And then number two.
So, sorry, just to kind of go back to this idea. So as I kind of read the district court's decision, it's concerned about the jury getting these, like, battle of experts and can't decide which has no basis to know which one's right. So why, like, is there, and maybe, you know, I would assume that the parties at trial would debate which experts are more believable or not. I mean, is there any basis in the backgrounds or the records, the party disputing that the other party's experts are not equally or credible in what they've put forth to think that they were actually wrong? So in the end, I think the district court's concerned that there's no basis to think either of these experts are better experts than others, so therefore they're all going to go for it and the jury's not going to have anything to see. So why isn't that, like, what is there that would be fought about in front of the jury that would either undermine credibility of the other party's witnesses?
And so I understand the respondent's position to be that their expert thinks it could be the extension cord or some other things that were not preserved at the scene. And what that goes back to is that this was a joint scene inspection. All of the parties and all of their experts were there. And all of the parties and all of their experts had a say on what did and what did not need to be preserved. And it was all of the experts' joint opinion that day that extension cord was not the cause of the fire. And in fact, that artifact didn't even need to be preserved. And for them to throw this in a report saying that something that they originally thought was nowhere near part of the fire that even had to be observed is disingenuous at that point. And the respondent's belief that our expert or Progressive's expert is not credible or not reliable, that was something that was brought in the district court or in the appellate court briefing that was not raised and not properly preserved for the court to consider today.
Even if it had been considered, right? I mean, the question of credibility at summary judgment, all the facts seem to be construed in your favor.
Exactly.
So following up on Judge Bentley's question, could the district court have even validly determined that both sets of experts were equally credible or not credible if it was correctly applying the summary judgment standard?
And our opinion is no. And I know I've said it before, but all roads lead back to the summary judgment standard. And what that requires the district court to have done here is to look at Progressive's evidence, well, to look at all of the evidence, and then to use Progressive's interpretation of the evidence to see if there's enough to where a jury would not have to speculate. And for a jury to have to speculate in Progressive's report, they would have had to leave some hole or some possibility that the fire was caused by an alternative cause that they had not considered. And that is not the case and not the expert report that Progressive has put forth. So the respondent did cite a couple cases, basically stating that circumstantial evidence could not be used. And I just want to briefly go through the one that's most on point. So Serapac concerns a negligent manufacturing claim where the plaintiff alleges a res ipsa argument, something that Progressive has never raised nor suggested in this case. And more importantly, Serapac is distinguished because the plaintiff failed to present expert testimony ruling out other potential causes for the defect. So while this is a negligent manufacturing case, I still believe that it is on point here, and because the court hasn't drawn a distinction between what's required for a negligent manufacturing case and what's required for a warranty case. But the difference here is that the plaintiff put forth no proof as to what happened versus the defendant's expert saying what happened, and the plaintiff had nothing to rebut. And so in this case, with the facts that we have, it presents a factual dispute that belongs to the jury. And at trial, Adventure can argue its alternative theories, as it's the jury's role to weigh the evidence and determine the credibility of those experts. And dismissing this case on the basis of speculative alternative causes supported solely by Adventure's expert opinions would be improper under the summary judgment standard. And I would ask this court to consider these arguments and remand this matter back to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Paul Darso of Tewksbury and Kerfeld, here on behalf of Respondent Adventure Manufacturing. I'd like to begin with a question that Judge Bentley asked, and that had to do with the burdens, the competing burdens back and forth, because I don't think it got answered respectfully. What I'm hearing opposing counsel say to this court this morning is that this court should conflate the summary judgment standard with Rule 12. As the court knows, on Rule 12, when you have a motion for a judgment on the pleadings, you consider only the factual allegations in the complaint, taking them as true, drawing reasonable inferences in favor of the plaintiff. That's not what the court does in summary judgment. On summary judgment, the court considers all of the evidence, provided it's admissible, because you have to have admissible evidence in order to show a genuine issue of material fact, and then asks itself one question. Does the evidence before me raise genuine issues of material fact? If it does, I've got to deny summary judgment. If it doesn't, I can grant summary judgment if the defendant shows that it is entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. And that is really important here because what opposing counsel just told this court, and I'm astonished to hear it, is that you don't even get to consider what's in Adventure's expert brief or expert reports. That's just verboten. It's as if it's an affirmative defense and an answer. That is not the law. That's not what our rules of civil procedure say. That is not the summary judgment standard. Now, to Judge Eade's question about, well, aren't there some basic things that they all agree in? I think there are, Your Honor. I think that all experts agree that there was a fire and that the fire originated in a location. But what's interesting about it is Mr. Dubbin says right in his report, and this is in the record at Index 37, Arch Declaration, Exhibit 16, page 11, the exact cause of the battery failure is not known at this time. And then what Mr. Dubbin also does is he says, well, it has to be the battery because, well, a battery is an object that contains stored energy. Well, gee, you'd want a battery to contain stored energy. I want this battery that's in this computer next to me to contain stored energy. Otherwise, if I got to refer to a case here, I'm in trouble. The whole thing falls apart, and I can't talk about cases with the court. So we can't honestly be saying that because a battery contains stored energy, it's defective. Where there,
how granular does the expert's opinion have to be then? I mean,
to survive summary judgment? I mean, does the expert have to explain the precise physics of what went on within the battery to cause the fire, other than the fact that the battery was manufactured and the fire started in the battery?
In some cases, it might, Judge, and that's a great question because that's right where I'm going next. Here we have opposing experts who say, look, this isn't as simple as it first looks. The battery appearance, for example, this is noted in Mr. Arms' report, would have been the same whether the battery itself was combusted or whether it was attacked by fire due to some other outside source. And he points to, and I could go through a whole litany of them. You've read them in our brief. I'm not going to repeat our brief, but the point is this, and this gets us back to the Serapac case. When there are other potential explanations for what happened, it is incumbent on the plaintiff's expert to account for them in some way. We would have a fact issue here. Let's say if there was a rebuttal report from Progressive's experts that said, yeah, well, Mr. Arms talks about the shore power cable extension cord. That doesn't matter for these reasons. Now we got a fact issue over that. Yes, there's extensive damage to the inverter, but the inverter could never have been the cause of the fire for these reasons. Now we've got a fact issue on that for the jury.
But doesn't that require that the district court credit the alternative explanations presented by your experts? If Progressive's experts are saying this is where we believe the fire started and the battery was the cause of the fire, and they don't present any alternative theories, then why isn't that enough to survive summary judgment? How does the district court determine that there are no genuine issues of material fact without making a credibility determination there that the alternative theories that your experts are presenting are viable and should be considered?
Because we're talking about legal sufficiency of evidence to create genuine issues of material fact, not who do you believe. And I would respectfully refer this court to Index 58, which is the transcript of the summary judgment hearing. Not once in there does Judge Sigmund ever say, gee, I think this set of experts is more credible than the other one. Or, I just don't think a jury would believe this, so I don't believe it. It's the same, Your Honor, as if, let's suppose, someone offered at summary judgment hearsay evidence. And they said, this creates a genuine issue of material fact. So then does that mean when a court rejects that evidence at summary judgment, because it's hearsay, it's inadmissible, then we're going to now say that, oh, the judge made a credibility determination because it didn't consider hearsay evidence believable. It's not about whether hearsay evidence is believable. It's about whether hearsay evidence is admissible and capable of creating a genuine issue of material fact. And in this case, we have case law that says, I cite the Serapac decision being one of them, that where there are competing causes and the plaintiff who has the burden of proof fails to address them all, well, then we haven't taken the matter out of the realm of speculation and conjecture.
Well, but doesn't, I guess as I understand their argument, and maybe you can tell me why you disagree with this, but that the point is that their expert's opinion was that the cause of the fire was the battery, period. So in some sense, it doesn't directly refute all of the alternative theories, but it provides an opinion that that was the cause. And that inherently creates a dispute about whether there are other causes. So why is it that, you know, and then I understand your point getting to, well, maybe we shouldn't, that wasn't enough for the reasons you said, they had to offer more to substantiate that claim. But let's say, for argument's sake, that there's enough in the expert report to support it, the position that the battery was the cause, taking the circumstantial evidence. And is that, why isn't that then enough to create a material dispute effect on the ultimate issue, which is what was the cause?
Your Honor, if I may ask by way of clarification, mm-hmm. What hypothetical are you putting before me? Because I'm understanding the court is asking two different things. If there had been an expert report from the plaintiff that actually said, it's the battery and here's why. Not, it's the battery because I can't identify anything else. It's the battery and here's why. we'd be in a different position. And I think that's what Your Honor is asking about.
Here well, so we, yeah, let's so you would agree in that scenario that there would be a material dispute of fact. They don't need to go through and refute every alternative theory.
Exactly.
So then we are kind of down to the question about was this expert report that we have sufficient to create to present evidence that that it was in fact the battery. So then we're in the circumstantial evidence world. Was that what the expert said enough to rise to that level? Is that right?
That's exactly.
And so why then? Yeah. So then maybe we should focus in on that. What is it about the report and looking at this the circumstantial evidence that wasn't sufficient in the report to create a genuine
issue? Mr. Dubbins himself says the exact cause of the battery failure is unknown at this time.
But why? So looking at there's the swallowing of sharp object thing. We don't know what the exact cause is, but it's a battery in a compartment. That, you know, nothing else is flammable. So and batteries typically don't just start on fire in 2 years. So there may be a defect. Why isn't that? That's how I at least understand the.
Oh,
argument.
Now wait a minute. Those are two different things. When I bite into a piece of pizza, I don't expect for my mouth to start bleeding. All right. This is a different situation here where we know where the fire started, generally speaking. But there has been no evidence, not even circumstantial evidence, of the battery being defective. And I want to raise something that counsel didn't in her argument, but I will. It's this business about the CT scan of the battery. You know, there's been argument there that the district court should never have considered that. In fact, it was improper. There's nothing in the record, yada, yada. Well, I will respectfully admit there's nothing in the record by way of the CT scan results, but there's also nothing in the record disputing that they had those results and chose to do nothing with them. Now, one would have to believe that if there was something in those CT scans that showed that the battery itself had a problem, their expert would be talking about it.
But that sounds like a really good argument for the jury, right?
Well, Your Honor, if the court is going to reverse the plaintiff's burden of proof and say that the defendant has the obligation of negating the plaintiff's case, which is not proper under our summary judgment standard, then yeah, let it reverse and let it go to the jury. But that's not the way this works. When other potential causes of the fire are identified and the plaintiff's expert himself or herself, whatever the case may be, cannot identify what the cause is, the plaintiff has failed in their burden of proof. Because what they're asking this court to do is then send it to the jury so we can all speculate about it. And that is just not proper under the rules and under our case law.
To jump back to your argument earlier, with the pizza, when you bite into a piece of pizza, you don't expect your mouth to start bleeding. I mean, there's a certain common sense causation there. And maybe it's almost res ipsa loquitur to say the pizza caused my mouth to bleed. But why wouldn't that be under the same reasoning? Why wouldn't the expert's opinion that the battery was where this fire started? I don't know what made the battery defective or the cause of the battery's failure, but why is it enough just to say the battery failed? Like what more is required in that situation?
Well, then aren't we into the territory where we reverse the Supreme Court's decision in the Lenz case from 1963 and say the mere occasion for injury is always proof that somebody did something wrong? I mean, that's the problem that you have in that circumstance. Again, we're talking about a specific situation in which the plaintiff's expert can't identify a specific defect.
Are we in that situation, though?
We are.
The injury was the fire, right? And it's not just that a fire occurred. It's that a fire occurred, and then an expert said the fire occurred in the battery, that's where the fire started. So it's not just that they've come to court and saying this RV caught on fire. They brought an expert that said this RV caught on fire, and the fire started in the battery that was manufactured by Adventure.
Okay, then based on what? What is the defect in the battery? They've never identified that. And they have to. They have to. Otherwise, if my computer that's sitting next to me here at this podium spontaneously combusts, Microsoft manufactured a defective product. That's not the way our product liability law works, and that's not the way burdens of proof work, respectfully. There has to be something more than that. Otherwise, the mere occasion for injury always means that someone's at fault. It's just not Minnesota law.
What's your best authority for that proposition?
That the mere occasion for injury
is... No. That in a product liability or in a situation like this where a battery starts on fire, that showing the precise nature of the defect is required to withstand summary judgment.
I'll refer the court back to the Serapac decision. That was a bottle of perfume. There was another potential cause for the injury. There was a chip at the end of the bottle. Okay? That was never ruled out by the plaintiff's expert. So you can't just say, gee, all I was doing was opening a bottle. I cut myself. They're at fault because this is defective. I mean, the case law is very clear on these points. This is not a situation where the district court weighed credibility. And I would respectfully ask this court not to fall for that delusion, because that's what this is. This is a determination of the legal sufficiency of evidence to create a genuine issue of material fact. It's not a matter of who you believe. And I just want to look at my notes here to see if there's one part I wanted to cover yet in the remaining minutes that I have left. I think a good way to look at it, that Nelson and Chatfield cases that have been talked about so much, very different situations. Chatfield involved paint that, no matter whether it was mixed with linseed oil or not, faded. That by itself rules out other potential causes, i.e., you didn't mix it with linseed oil. And the Nelson case is distinguishable, again, because there were actual defects. And with that, I'd ask the court respectfully to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'd first like to get back to Judge Bentley's question when she asked whether a battle of the experts is allowed in front of the jury. And the answer is yes. That is what always happens. If every case with conflicting expert opinions were decided at a summary judgment stage, no product liability case would ever make it to a jury, which is problematic, as the jury, not the judge, is the trier of fact.
As I see it, this boiling down is really about whether or not your expert's report was sufficient to even support the claim that the position that the battery was defective or that something that it started there, right? Because if that's enough, then it seems to create a fact on the ultimate question. But if it's relies on speculation, then we have these other things hanging. So regardless of the credibility or not, it seems like, is the report enough? So can you just address that question about, and maybe this goes back again to the circumstantial evidence or whether, but I think to his point that you have to show what it was that caused the fire in the battery or otherwise, like, you know, we're left.
Yes, Your Honor. So I'll start with the case that the respondent cited, which is Serapac. Serapac, again, there was an expert on the defendant's side. There was no one on the plaintiff's side. They couldn't put forth the evidence. The Serapac case didn't meet the Schaefer standard. Our case does. And here, we're able to say that there was a defect. We're just not able to say why the defect failed. Our expert can say that the battery is the one that ignited. They were able to rule out Peterson's action or inaction or misuse. They're just not able to say exactly why that failed. And now that's not a problem, because we go back to the Nelson case specifically. The Nelson case...
So are you saying the battery ignition is the defect?
Yes. And for that example, counsel states when he bites into a piece of pizza, he doesn't expect his mouth to bleed. Just like Mr. Peterson didn't expect his two-month-old RV to burst into flames while it was parked and while it was unoccupied. And that goes exactly back to the Nelson case with the circumstantial evidence and what is and isn't allowed. In the Nelson case, the plaintiff bought a vehicle from a dealership. The dealership provided them with the knowledge that was a new vehicle. Within a month, there were all kinds of problems with the vehicle itself. It had a problem with the horn. It had problem with a wiper. It had problem with the taillights. It had problems with the paint bubbling. It had all kinds of problems that a new vehicle should not have within a month of purchase. And the court was able to say, and the Supreme Court in fact found, that the early appearance presented a fact question as to whether the vehicle was fit for ordinary use, because fit vehicles probably do not display these defects this early, even if driven a great deal within a short period of time. This is the same standard of proof here in the circumstantial evidence. And quite frankly, it's our belief that we have enough evidence with just the RV that burst into flames within 2 months. But even so, we've gone farther. We've gotten our expert involved. We've gotten our expert to make a determination on the origin of the fire.
But did your expert only really get you to the point, as in Sarah Pack, of, you know, that this is where the injury happened, not how the injury occurred? You know, like, it, so in Sarah Pack, the plaintiff didn't have an expert, but it was clear that the injury happened when she twisted off the cap, right? So, you know, to, I think, your counterpart's point, the expert here doesn't go any further to say how this injury happened. And so I'm wondering how you distinguish that and why the lack of an expert for the plaintiff in Sarah Pack matters.
It's because we go back to the Schaefer case, and Nelson and Chatfield, they allow the circumstantial evidence, but Schaefer puts in the extra layer, and they say, hey, you have to make sure that you can rule out any use or misuse of it. And so our expert went farther, and there's nothing here that they left open that could be any part of anyone else's issue other than Adventurer's issue. They've ruled out anything Matthew Peterson has done, and there's nobody else to blame. All roads leads back to Adventurer in that question. And my time is up. And if you have no further questions, I'll just ask the court respectfully that you remand this to the district court so that we can continue further litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate both of your briefs and argument this morning. The case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the matter within the time prescribed by statute.